Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. I'm Caroline Bryant, and I'm the Associate Director of Practice Groups with the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this webinar titled A 2025 Review of the Governance, Mission, and Independence of the Federal Reserve. If you'd like to learn more about today's speakers and moderator, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. After our panel gives their presentations, we will turn to you, to the audience, for questions. If you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window. We will do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers, not the Federalist Society. With that, Professor Christina Skinner from the Wharton School has graciously offered to introduce Congressman Lucas. The floor is yours, Christina.
Thank you for that, Caroline, and welcome to our audience. We appreciate you zooming in with us this afternoon. And as Caroline mentioned, it's really my pleasure to introduce you to our keynote speaker, Congressman Frank Lucas. And it's such a privilege and an opportunity to hear from Representative Lucas as chair of the House Financial Service Committee's relatively new task force on monetary policy, treasury market resilience, and economic prosperity. So we'll hear from the Congressman for about 10 minutes, and then I'll take the liberty of following up with a couple of questions. At that point, I will turn the panel over to Andrew Ullman, who will moderate the rest of the event. Andrew is the managing partner of Mayor Brown in Washington, D.C., and has formerly held the positions of deputy director of the National Economic Council during President Trump's first administration and formerly Republican chief counsel at the Senate Banking Committee. So, Congressman, thank you again so much for joining us. We look forward to hearing your remarks.
Thank you for having me. And I'm pleased to join you today to discuss what I consider to be one of the most pressing issues of our time, monetary policy and treasury market resilience. It may be a slight coincidence that these topics are also the focus of the task force where I serve as chairman. The topics we'll discuss through the work of the task force have never had a specific home. That is, they floated between the various subcommittee jurisdictions of financial services, never really getting the attention that they're due. This lack of clear jurisdiction has caused the subject matter, and in particular, the treasury market, to be somewhat neglected in Congress's past. That's why I'm grateful to the chairman of the Financial Services Committee, Mr. Hill, for creating a dedicated task force to these issues and entrusting me with its leadership. The Task Force on Monetary Policy, Treasury Market Resilience, and Economic Prosperity is charged with examining issues related to monetary policy, the Federal Reserve Act, and how economic growth and price stability affect the financial well-being of all Americans. Last month, the task force held its first hearing on the Fed's toolkit as it conducts monetary policy, and I was grateful that Dr. Don Cohn for testifying, and I'm pleased to join him at this event today. Aside from just monetary policy, the task force also has jurisdiction over the treasury market, so we'll pay special attention to the fundamental role that U.S. Treasury debt plays in our economy. We'll look at the recent stresses the market has faced and how to better increase liquidity and stability for the market and its participants. As an example, I have continued to push the Fed to finally revisit the supplemental leverage ratio and enhanced supplementary leverage ratio. The last few times I've spoken with him, Chairman Powell agreed with me that U.S. Treasury should be exempt from the SLR and the ESLR. Ratios that do not take risk into account don't make sense. Why would we punish primary market dealers and constrain their balance sheets for purchasing a nearly risk-free asset that they are required to bid on? I hope we see this addressed in the near term as myself and the Secretary Bessette continue to raise the issue. The next task force hearing is just a week away from today, and we'll discuss the relationships between and among public and private actors in the Treasury markets and how Treasuries are utilized to affect Main Street and Wall Street. I hope you'll tune in to that discussion next Tuesday. Finally, the task force will give consideration to how the Federal Reserve interacts with the Treasury market, whether good, bad, or ugly. I'll continue to hold the Fed's feet to the fire on the management of its balance sheet. They are much better at purchasing treasuries than they are about selling them or rolling them off. The Fed has yet to have an honest assessment about the mistakes during QE4 that led to such record high inflation. But today, I want to focus my comments on the statement I made a few moments ago, that these are some of the most pressing issues of our time. Now, I'm a product of Roger Mills County, Oklahoma. That part of the country was one of the hardest hit during the great devastation of the Great Depression of the 1930s. I was raised by a generation who were young men and women during that time, who lived through the intense economic pain of that period. And then when I graduated from college in 1982, I saw both the ag environment and the energy environment collapse as the two driving forces of my hometown economy during that period. I know many of you have stories like me. We all have personal experiences of how decisions made in Washington, D.C. or New York City directly affect our families, our communities. Every time I read an FOMC statement of policy or listen to Chairman Powell testify, I think about those stories. We live in the richest country in the world with the deepest and safest and most liquid markets. We benefit from our treasury market serving as the foundation of the global financial system, and our central bank has weathered over 100 years of storms. But none of that is an accident. It is policy decisions that can strengthen or weaken the health of our financial institutions and systems. We cannot be asleep at the wheel. Our constituents back home depend on our robust oversight of the Federal Reserve, its actions, its effects on the markets, and its ever-creeping oversight of credit providers. I understand that through today's event, we'll discuss the origin and evolution of the Federal Reserve System's independence, its role in promoting maximum employment and price stability, and its supervisory and regulatory functions under the Dodd-Frank Act. I'm the only Republican member left on the Financial Services Committee that was a conferee on the Dodd-Frank Conference Committee. I remember those hard-fought negotiations well. Now, almost 20 years later, it's past time we examine many of the provisions of that bill and discuss, are we sure we want 20 more years of this? One last point of personal privilege. The very first chairman of the very first chairman of the Senate Banking Committee was one of my very own first senators from Oklahoma, Robert Owen. Senator Owen was an architect of the Federal Reserve Act of 1913 that gives us the central bank charter we are discussing today. My constituents back home treasure the Oklahoma tradition of giving the Fed a hard time. And I believe we have a unique opportunity to actually address in a careful manner some of the challenges we faced over the past several decades when it comes to these issues. And I know you will be great partners in this effort. I thank you again for having me and for engaging in this important discussion.
Well, thank you very much, Congressman, for those insightful comments and giving us a window into what you are thinking about, you and your colleagues are thinking about in the task force. So if I may, I'd love to invite you to tell us a little bit about what you and your colleagues ultimately hope to accomplish with the task force. Do you see this work as primarily a vehicle for enhancing oversight and informing the public, which are laudable goals in their own right? Or do you think that there's some appetite for legislative change?
Chairman Hill has made it clear that this is a legislative exercise. We will notice bills to our hearings, and our legislative recommendations will go straight to the full committee for consideration. As I said in my remarks, this is not an academic or theoretical conversation. There are real challenges in the market that Congress must and should address. I'll work to build consensus with other members of the task force, and we'll produce reports investigations, legislation that will reflect where we think the improvements can be made. Our task force has already sent two oversight letters to Chairman Powell on the SLR and Acting Chairman Yehuda and the Treasury on the clearing rule. You can expect substantial policy work to come from the task force. That's why Chairman Hill set us up, and that's what we intend to do.
Thank you for that. So I want to transition now to a more specific subject under that umbrella that really gets at the interaction between monetary policy and fiscal policy and the debt markets, which you will so rigorously study. And, you know, you've touched upon, I think the task force plans to touch upon the subject of debt management. I was wondering if you could speak to our audience a little bit about your perspective, your colleagues' perspective on the relationship between the Treasury and the Fed more generally.
The strains that we saw on the Treasury market in 2020 were always going to require some sort of federal intervention. There are just too much dynamic economic damage done from the pandemic. But generally speaking, the central bank should have a posture of do no harm to the markets and its participant. The Fed's use of the balance sheet to set policy, rather than using reserves or the federal funds rate, is quite unconventional. And I expect many members of the task force to want to discuss the appropriate size of the Fed's balance sheet and the market's reaction to quantitative tightening. This is a popular question from my members at our first monetary policy hearing, and I would think our discussion of the framework review after Jackson Hole, folks, we'll have more to say.
Thank you. And on that subject of the balance sheet and QE and QT, I would love to ask you about a piece of co-authored work I have with Professor Andy Levin and some ideas that we espoused in that paper. And, you know, in that particular piece of work, we really, again, urged for more congressional accountability when it comes to QE, more specifically, you know, discussions with Congress about when to initiate an emergency bond buying program, at what pace, some sort of format for briefings about the costs and the benefits, retrospective analysis. You mentioned some of these things. And we acknowledge that there is some sensitivity to these programs during a crisis. And so we suggested something of a national security briefing model as a potential solution. I'm curious to know your thoughts on that and if that's something that maybe the task force is willing to discuss.
Well, in your paper on the subject, you quote former Fed Chair Bernanke, who says, it's up to Congress to set our structure, to set our mandate. And that's entirely legitimate. We need to go and explain ourselves. I think that's exactly right. Congress has oversight authority over the Fed, period. There is the balance of protecting the central bank from political interference when it comes to monetary policy. But that doesn't mean the Fed gets a free pass on their supervision and regulatory activities. The stress tests are a huge constraint on banks' balance sheets, which cause capacity challenges for the Treasury market. And Congress has almost no transparency in this process. There are many examples like this that we need to increase accountability for.
Well, thank you, Congressman. We're sensitive to constraints on your time. And again, just want to thank you very much for speaking to our audience about the very important work of the task force. So with that, I'll thank you again and hand things over to Andrew Ullman to moderate the rest of our panel. Thank you again, Congressman Lucas.
Thank you.
Thank you, Congressman, and thank you, Christina, for that great introduction and for all your work, Congressman, on these important issues. So with that, let me introduce our two additional panelists who really do need no introduction. They are well-known and well-respected on any conversation on Fed policy. The first is Don Cohn, who holds the Robert V. Rosa Chair in International Economics and is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He's also the former vice chair of the Federal Reserve. He is a, I believe, 40-year veteran of the Federal Reserve, and I think it's fair to say that there's not a person alive who has more institutional history with the Fed than Don Cohn. Also joining us is Alex Pollack, who is a senior fellow at the von Mises Institute. He's the former principal deputy director of the Office of Financial Research at the U.S. Treasury Department. And he's also a former CEO of the Federal Home Loan Bank of Chicago. Now, the place I want to start our discussion is, Christina, is, you know, you mentioned that you've done some writing about Fed governance and the importance of Congress looking at ways to hold the Fed more accountable. What's your reaction to the congressman's agenda that he laid out here out there for the task force? Is this what you're looking for?
Well, thanks for the question, Andrew. Always welcome the opportunity to chat about my research agenda and the connection to policy. So I think absolutely the task force is, you know, onto some of the areas that I've tried to highlight in my own research. You know, the congressman mentioned very briefly at the end of his remarks the need to think critically about the Fed supervision and regulation function. So, you know, last year at the Hoover Monetary Policy Conference, I presented a paper that was on the role of the vice chair for supervision, but was really meant to prompt us to revisit the way that we think about central bank independence in a world where central banks, not only the Fed, but all over the world, sort of do more and more, right? And so in this paper, and, you know, still today, I'm arguing to, you know, take another look at supervision and regulation, right? Supervision and regulation is a different beast from monetary policy. It's really a coercive power of the state. And so, at least in the way that we think about administrative agencies within our constitutional framework, this is a paradigmatic executive function that doesn't necessarily deserve the same sorts of assumptions about independence that we afford to monetary policy, right? The Supreme Court has been clear that for any function that is such an executive function, the president has to have plenary power to supervise and control those functions. So I think the task force is right to think about how supervision and regulation is done at the Fed and whether there needs to be more accountability, not just to Congress, but also to the executive branch. You know, the congressman also hit on the subject of the balance sheet and QE. I think that's another really important area for the task force to focus on. You know, I mentioned the paper that I have with Andy Levin, sort of explaining why we would want to see more congressional accountability. You know, I hope that the task force also thinks about more executive accountability in connection with QE as well. You know, ultimately, quantitative easing performs a debt management function. It's shortening the maturity structure of the U.S. debt. And so this, you know, also requires some kind of formal and publicly observable coordination with Treasury. Not to mention that QE has the potential to engage in real sort of credit allocation, which demands subjective value judgments that require political accountability. So I think, you know, the balance sheet, rules around the balance sheet, supervision and regulation, and I think payments activity also is probably something that the task force should focus on in terms of, you know, whether the Fed has perhaps too much autonomy in the design of that policy arena.
Christina, just one follow-up then is on the vice chair position, what do you believe the legal kind of consequences are of your analysis there that it's a different function? What does that mean for policy?
Yeah, I mean, so the most direct policy implication is that the vice chair for supervision role, at least the way that it's currently constituted, should be considered an at-will position, right? Precisely for these constitutional reasons that I was mentioning, and conceptualizing or sort of practicing in a world where the vice chair for supervision is an at-will removable position by the presidency should not have implications for the independence of the monetary policy function. But I think even sort of broader than that, and more so on a day-to-day basis, you know, inherent in the ability to remove is sort of the lesser power to supervise the execution of tasks and the formulation of policy. And, you know, this leads us right into one of President Trump's recent recent executive orders on independent agency accountability, which specifically brought into its ambit the supervision and regulation function of the Fed. You know, I think for, you know, those who have questioned the executive order and suggested that it's anathema to central bank independence, well, for precisely the reasons I set out, I think that position is wrong. I think that the president does have the constitutional responsibility, not just authority, to, you know, supervise the function of supervision and regulation at the Fed and at the other agencies. So practically speaking, I think that's where things land, that we may move to a world in which the role of supervision and regulation is going to have more executive accountability going forward.
Yes. So for our viewers who might not be as familiar with that executive order, it's the executive order 14-215 entitled Ensuring the Accountability for All Agencies. And that executive order requires all independent agencies, including the Federal Reserve, to submit draft regulations to the OMB for review and to consult with the White House on their policy priorities. It also gives OMB authority to review their budgets. It does, as you think you noted, carve out the Fed's monetary policy. So this is a significant change in how the federal government operates with respect to independent agencies. So maybe that's a good place to transition to you, Don. Right? Fed independence, that is something that's been core to the Fed for a long time. But I think as we've seen pretty in the wake of Dodd-Frank where the Federal Reserve's responsibilities really grew in the non-monetary policy space and for supervision over banked payment systems and just systemic risk regulation, there has been a real interest in Congress and from the executive branch in determining whether or not more presidential or congressional oversight is needed. What's your view on the executive order to start?
Well, I don't, not being an attorney, but being an economist, I don't really have a view on the executive order, but I do think that I agree with Christina that supervision regulation is a different beast, but it's not the borders between supervision regulation and monetary policy and between supervision regulation and discount window administration, another very key function of the Federal Reserve, are quite fuzzy. And there's a lot of interaction between them. So I think there are some impediments to making a completely separate thing and taking one thing and making it not independent and the other thing independent. And I think these interactions, the effects of what supervision regulation have on the conduct of monetary policy, importantly, the information flow between the regulators and the supervisors and the monetary policymakers and the discount window, the people administering the discount window, is really critical. And I think our experience in the financial crisis, for example, was that we couldn't have run either monetary policy or discount window without having a very close working relationship with the supervisors and regulators. I think it's fair to say even before the executive order and Christina's work on making SNR even more independent, there was always a bifurcation, right? So the Federal Reserve couldn't regulate and supervise banks without cooperation of the other bank supervisors. So the Office of Comptroller of Currency, the FDIC, and those offices turned over when the White House turned over. So it was never a question of, and I always thought of independence as bifurcated, much more for monetary policy than supervision and regulation. But I think particularly there's an intersection in financial stability and financial crises that we can't ignore. The fact that the Open Market Committee is getting briefings these days on financial stability suggests that the committee recognizes that it needs to know more. And just as I say, administering the discount window, you really do have to have the supervisors and the regulators and have to have instant access to information. My experience in the crisis was not every other agency was as responsive as the people that I was working with in the Federal Reserve. And to make a decision, should we lend to this company? Should we lend to that? How deep is this recession going to be? How strong does the monetary policy reaction need to be? I needed to have needed to rely on the supervision regulatory function.
No, just though, I don't hear anything, though, Don, in that critique that would mean that removal, just the vice chair position, would be an impediment to the operation of the feds, either on monetary policy or on banking supervision.
Yes. So making that an at will.
Yeah.
As Christina
has put out.
Yeah. So I think, in effect, Michael Barr acted as if it was at will by resigning his position. So I don't know whether Christina's proposal was this person should resign from the board as well as from his or her.
Christina, I think it was just the vice chair, right?
Yeah.
Just the vice chair role.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he just resigned the vice chair role, yeah, in effect, avoiding the question of should it be treated differently. I guess in my core is protecting that monetary policy independence, and I haven't thought about what Christina's proposal might, how that might spill over, sure, to the monetary policy. The other point I'd make is that, of course, regulation is a board function. Yep. It's true that one person was put in charge of formulating the proposals to come to the board, et cetera, but it is a board function. So I'm not sure how you can make one person different from the other six members of the board, how that would work.
Alex, let me turn to you. You know, let's just stay on the topic of kind of banking supervision. You know, what's your view? What do you think the right balance is on terms of independence versus accountability for banking supervision at the Fed?
I don't think in my own mind, the supervision is that much different from the monetary policy. That is to say, I am a skeptic of the concept that any part of the government could be independent from the rest of the government. I always think in this context of that great chairman of the Federal Reserve, William McChesney Martin, and the saying of his day to which he ascribed, which is that the Federal Reserve independence is not independence from the government, it's independence within the government, as they said. That seems to me absolutely right. And if you're independent within the government, that means you're not really independent. You have all kinds of political ties. But these two are, in my view, most important. That is, the Fed, for monetary policy, maybe this will get to your question, Andrew, for monetary policy, should be basically independent of the Treasury. The whole problem with the central bank is you don't want the central bank to be the slave of the Treasury to monetize the debt that the Treasury is always anxious to sell and reduce the cost of that debt below in an active market. On the other hand, the regulatory function, so relatively independent of the executive for monetary policy, but accountable to the Congress and responsible to the general direction, not only oversight in my mind, but direction of the Congress. It's the Congress that has the constitutional money power to coin, or we might say in more modern language, to create money and regulate the value thereof. Article 1, Section 8 of the U.S. Constitution, that's a congressional power. And I think that when Congressman Lucas said they're going to have a robust oversight of the Federal Reserve, that's terrific. That's what they should have from the Congress. I think the congressman was absolutely right that there was no part of the Congress that was focused on the Fed in recent days. There used to be. Hey, Don, in the days of Wright Patman, I'm not sure you go back to Wright Patman. In the days of Wright Patman, there was a lot of focus on the Fed and the Congress. The Fed didn't like it. But there should be focus. And I think this task force in that way is a great idea. It is a center of jurisdiction for both monetary policy, in my mind, and regulatory policy. But the balance is different, Andrew, between the two. More to the Congress in the first instance on monetary policy, and more to the executive, in my view, on regulation. But think of big monetary questions, and what should the Fed be able to do by itself? Mm-hmm. And what should it take? What should take approval of the elected representatives of the people? Well, could the Fed by itself put the United States back on the gold standard? That's a big monetary question. No. Could it require true silver coinage of precious metal coins of intrinsic value? No. Could it set a perpetual depreciation of the purchasing power of the dollar at some rate? Let's say 2% a year. In my view, the answer is no, that was a decision that needed to be taken for approval to the Congress, and isn't valuable unless it was. Now, it's true that Chairman Bernanke went around and talked to some congressmen, right, about it, but that's completely different from taking it to
right. The 2% target is not in statute, but there is, just to play devil's advocate, Alex, there is the Humphrey-Hawkins Act. So it's not as if Congress hasn't legislated on this. So I think the question for you then is, if Congress hasn't been as specific enough about its goals, I think the goals for the Fed are pretty clear, like low inflation and low unemployment, maximizing both of those functions. It seems to be your critique here is that they haven't been specific enough on the goals. But that's different than not having any goals.
There are goals, but remember the goal as stated in the Federal Reserve Reform Act of 1977, which is the Basic Act, is stable prices. Stable prices, not perpetual inflation. And there are three goals: stable prices, maximum employment, and moderate long-term interest rates. Well, right. That's statute. Who has paid any attention to moderate long-term interest rates? Nobody, but it's in the statute. Should we fix that? Shall we say that stable prices means perpetual inflation? Or shall we say, as the Humphrey-Hawkins Act said, stable prices should mean zero inflation in 10 years? That's what Humphrey-Hawkins said. I don't mean to say I know the answer, but I know that in my view, it takes congressional approval. And if we look at foreign examples, say New Zealand, the father of inflation targeting, the original inflation target was an agreement between the government, that's in case of parliamentary government, and the central bank. I think that's what we should be heading for, on fundamental large questions, not details of implementation. I got a few other ideas, but
sure. So let me just go to Don real quick.
Something else.
Yeah, let me flip to Don. Just Don, I think Alex does have a point about maybe Congress should be more specific about what the goals should be. Any thought there? Clearly, if Congress comes in and is more specific, that shouldn't be too much of a problem. Now, we can debate what it is, but being more specific maybe helps the Fed perform its task better.
So I think what would help the Fed perform its task better is what this task force has been set up to do. Mm-hmm. As the congressman said, I testified in front of the task force a few weeks ago, and I'm really quite supportive of helping the Congress oversee the Fed. Alex is right. They said price stability.
Yep.
They didn't say 2%. Now, some of that 2%, as Alex knows, is measurement error and bias. So it's not really not really 2%. But I think a fair point would be for the Congress, particularly with this framework review, to ask the Federal Reserve to justify the 2%. So remember, Paul Volcker and Alan Greenspan defined price stability as inflation low enough that households and businesses don't have to consider it in their everyday decisions and in their planning. So our question is 2% low enough to fulfill? Is that the right definition of price stability? People can ignore this inflation, or is it too high? And then if it is too high, are there costs from reducing it? And then you get into this issue of low nominal rates and negative shocks and whatnot. But it's perfectly legitimate for the Congress to say, and this came up at the hearing a couple of weeks ago, for the Congress to say to the Fed, how did you get to 2%? Why isn't it 1? Why isn't it 3 that many academics are advocating? What's your rationale? That would be a good hearing.
Fully agree with everything Don just said. And the corollary to that is, it is not a unilateral decision of the central bank. And I think in almost no country that I'm aware of was it a unilateral decision. It was an agreement between the parliamentary government, in most cases, and the central bank. And it should be here, in my opinion. Could I add a couple other things?
I haven't asked you, Alex, your view of the executive order, and whether or not you think subjecting Federal Reserve rules to the OIRA process is problematic, or is that just ensuring good administration of the executive branch?
I don't have strong views on that, except that I think that the regulatory process, whether you're the controller of the currency, or the FDIC, or the credit union administration, or the Federal Reserve, is part of the general government and its give and take. And I don't believe in independence, as I said.
But that would seem to be fine with treating rules from the Fed just like we do all the other agencies.
Yeah, I think there's an argument for that. That's not one of my. I feel less vibrant about that than I feel about the monetary thing, because unlike what Christina said, she said what is true, which is that regulation is a mandatory putting onto the society of decisions, but so is money. Nothing is more an influence on the society in general than the mandatory decisions of the government about the kind of money that's imposed on the society by the government. I got three other points I want to make quickly.
Okay.
Something else Congress should be doing, and this task force should be doing, heavily analyzing the Fed's financial statements, really understanding them. Now, as nobody knows better than Don, the Fed has now lost $225 billion cash operating losses, and they have a mark-to-market loss of $1.06 trillion. That's a total loss of $1.25 trillion. That's real money. The Congress should really understand what is going on. What does it mean? Was that worth it? Mm-hmm. While they're at it, we had Andy Levin, Christina's co-author, commenting on the high level of the Fed's expenses. Now, we used to say, well, the Fed is self-funding. It makes all this money. It can pay its expenses. But that's not true. If the Fed is losing $225 billion or $1 trillion, depending on how you look at it, that's one. Second thing is, the task force should be looking at the risk of the Fed. The Fed undertook in its QE, especially in the continuing versions of it. QE1, to my mind, is more justifiable than its younger siblings. Undertook tremendous risk, and it was actually a risk of taxpayer money. These are fiscal responsibilities that the losses create, higher deficits and higher debt of the Treasury. And now Congress should understand the risk that the Fed is taking. I don't think that, to my knowledge, Don, maybe I'm wrong, I don't think the Fed ever came to the Congress and talked about the risk of its incredible interest rate positions, which were just naked long, as I like to say, like a 1980s SNL. And finally, this is my last point, Andrew, then I'll shut up. The task force should take up the Fed's accounting. I think the Fed's claim that it can set its own accounting standards is a fundamental conflict of interest. No one gets to set their own accounting. And the Congress, government of Switzerland mandates that the Swiss Central Bank must mark its operations to market and run the mark to market through its profit and loss statement and its capital account. Well, that's one approach. Government of Canada mandates that the Bank of Canada has to follow international accounting standards. I don't think anybody should get to set their own accounting. It's too big a conflict of interest, especially when you're doing extremely risky things and losing a lot of money. So I hope the task force will get into accounting. I'll go advise them if they ask me.
That's right. Okay, let me go back to Christina here. And what kind of struck me too, Christina, with the congressman's remarks is he did say, you know, the Fed does not get a free pass on its banking supervision. And particularly, there's no transparency on the stress tests. And what I think is interesting about those comments is that it shows that, you know, the Fed's responsibilities post Dodd-Frank have grown and that the stress tests, you know, have a really big potential impact on overall economic activity in the United States. And from Congress' perspective, the impact on everyday Americans is real of those stress tests. And they now feel that is even when you can see the congressman was clearly trying to provide some deference to the Fed, at the same time felt clearly compelled to spend more time examining those stress tests just because of the impact on their constituents. So kind of question for you is, you know, is how much should we expect Congress to be able to defer, and should we want it to defer to the Fed now that its responsibilities have grown beyond just coming up determining monetary policy and managing inflation, but now is moving into more macroprudential regulation of the economy?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I really liked how the congressman sort of tied things back to, you know, this is not just a subject matter for experts, economists, lawyers, but what the central bank does and sort of its policy ramifications today, and perhaps, you know, arguably always, really affect everyday Americans, right? So it's part of the economic prosperity piece of the task force. And the question of discretion, I think, is the question of the day, right? Again, setting monetary policy to one side, there is a lot of discretion that's built into the broadly worded mandates attached to the Fed's supervision and regulation function, right? Safety and soundness is a broadly worded term. And so is the term financial stability, right? And in fact, you know, as we on the panel know, the Fed doesn't actually have an express financial right. stability mandate at all. And so what I heard Congressman Lucas saying is, you know, we need to dig in here. And, you know, unlike monetary policy, where we have sort of this time inconsistency problem, where maybe we see an argument for, you know, considerable discretion in monetary policy, when it comes to supervision and regulation, you know, perhaps Congress needs to be, you know, again, hold the Fed's feet to the fire, right? A perfect example of this, you know, stress testing, yes, but also the proposed Basel endgame rules, right? You saw Congress really dig in and focus here because, as you were saying, you know, Congress started to hear from its constituents, you know, we're worried about our ability to access credit, right? And so they were sort of hearing from constituents, hearing from the industry. And part of the reason I think Basel Endgame went so far off the rails was because there was so much assumed discretion going in, and this sort of inflated view of what is encompassed under the term financial stability. So one of the things I would love the task force to focus on is the transparency piece. Yes, but also being a little bit more precise with these supervisory mandates, right? What does safety and soundness mean? What is an actionable financial stability risk, right? Is the Fed actually required to do some kind of cost-benefit analysis justifying, you know, what is otherwise a very, you know, hypothetical term in financial stability risk? Because again, sort of everyday Americans really are affected when banks pull back from lending, right? Not only because it's harder to get bank-based credit, but because you see things move around in the financial system more generally, and that just sort of fundamentally affects market structure and what our economy looks like. So there are some really big picture questions that I think have exceeded sort of the justifiability of the Fed's, you know, discretion, independence, basically, right? The same thing in the supervision regulation space.
Don, I see you wanting to jump in. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Andrew. So bringing to some extent my experience at the Bank of England, where I was 10 years on the Financial Policy Committee responsible for financial stability in the UK. So a couple of comments. One is, I think the Federal Reserve was founded as a macroprudential body. Why was it founded? Basically for the discount window and to fight crises, to make sure there weren't fires, runs and fire sales on banks, a function that it did not perform in 1929 to 1933. So I think it had, there's a long history. It's true that the financial stability per se is not in the Federal Reserve Act, but the whole act was premised on financial stability and having an institution that would preserve it.
Although on that one, Don, I think I want to push back a little bit, right? You know, I'll note that during the conference on Dodd-Frank, that issue of giving the Federal Reserve a financial stability mandate was voted on, and it was voted down. So Congress actually has spoken to this. So there, and also it does seem to me to be that certainly the role of the lender of last resort could better be described, right, as a more of a crisis management function. And also, I think the history of that is to have established an elastic currency, right, to make sure that during seasonal demands and during bank panics, the currency could expand. But it wasn't about modern macroprudential, where you're talking about, you know, changing leverage ratios and capital requirements.
But if you read some of the stuff that was written around the founding of the Fed, a lot of it was, great, we won't have panics and crises because this institution is there and willing to use its balance sheet to support the system.
That's an argument on the QE side, not on the regulatory.
My experience. Go ahead, Alex. I'm sorry.
No, I'm just saying I agree with you. I'm trying to support you.
Thank you. I think my experience testifying in front of Congress is they think when something bad goes wrong, they look to the Fed.
Oh, sure. Definitely.
And they blame the Fed, even if it's OTS's problem or someone else's. And we tried to do, this is another issue that maybe ought to be thought about, as I think back to the pre-global financial crisis years, the Fed tried to tighten up on subprime lending, on commercial real estate, and there was huge pushback from other agencies, particularly OTS, which was destroyed by the crisis. I get that. But other agencies, so it's the coordination does constrain the Federal Reserve quite a bit. And the second point I wanted to make is about time and consistency. So I do think there's a problem in regulation that way. I think whenever you ask the industry and however much influence they have, they're going to push for easier regulations, less intrusive supervision, and not take into account the overall system, which was our job on the Financial Policy Committee at the Bank of England, was to coordinate with the microprudential regulators to make sure the system and to stress test the system to see whether it was sound. So I think Congress was right to emphasize the stress tests in Dodd-Frank. I think the Fed can probably be more transparent and they're looking to do that. But I do think we have to be careful not to be so transparent that it undermines the efficacy of this very important financial stability tool.
Yeah, I think they've done there's clearly bipartisan support for the stress tests. And I'm trying to think if I actually ever heard anybody say that they shouldn't do them. I think the question is, though, right, is that transparency element? And this is, I think this is a difficult question, as I was saying before. It has such a big, could have such a potentially big impact on the U.S. economy. You know, for the average voter, you know, that's something that they want to make sure they, you know, their members of Congress at least understand, because it's going to have an impact. I mean, that's just a basic element of democracy, that important decisions are one that are being approved of either directly or indirectly by elected officials. And like the lack of transparency there clearly has made Congress uneasy about what the Fed's doing.
Right. And so I agree with you. Congress should be pushing very hard. Why are you doing what you're doing? What degree of transparency what is the maximum degree of transparency that's consistent with accomplishing these objectives for financial stability? Those are very good questions, and Congress should be asking those.
Christina, I'd like to hear you talk a little bit more about kind of the president's role. You heard Alex and Don be very supportive if you're of Congress having a strong role. What additional value does maybe potentially having the president have more, besides simply nomination, which is certainly an important tool, but kind of a one-hit wonder in terms of accountability, more authority over particularly banking and maybe even monetary policy?
Yeah, that's an important question, and one that, the media and the public is really focused on right now. I mean, I think taking a step back, it is important for us, experts in the central banking space, to revisit our assumptions around central bank independence, specifically in regard to accountability to the presidency. And I know I sort of said this before, but in a world where the central bank is doing more and more, I don't think it's justifiable anymore to assume that everything is off limits in terms of presidential accountability, right? And there are, again, two big picture reasons why. One is constitutional and one is statutory. From a constitutional standpoint, again, putting monetary policy to the side, the structure of the Constitution requires that all agencies be understood to sit within the executive branch to help the president implement and enforce the law. And monetary policy is not supposed to be the exception that swallows the rule in regard to the Fed. And this is important for several reasons that I'll get to right now. I think Congress clearly understood the importance of this dynamic when it drafted the Federal Reserve Act. Right there in the text in Section 10.6 of the Federal Reserve Act, it clearly says where there's jurisdictional overlap between the Treasury and the Fed, the Treasury is meant to supervise and control. And the translation of that is that Congress understood that the central bank might one day be called on to do quasi-fiscal things like quantitative easing, even if it couldn't imagine that unconventional policy at the time, or that the central bank might be doing things to help out with economic governance more generally. But in those cases, there should be some presidential accountability. So you ask, what does it add? Well, I think it adds something significant when we get into, credit allocation space or debt management phase, right? That's quantitative easing. I think, more executive accountability also adds something when we start thinking about those Section 13.3 emergency liquidity facilities, right? I mean, I think it makes sense to have some amount of Treasury accountability there, perhaps, sitting down in non-crisis times and designing, right, with the Fed, right, with some accountability from the presidency, the set of conditions in which the Fed can justifiably deploy a 13.3 facility, because at this point they've become more than just ad hoc rescue packages, right? They're really setting expectations about the size and the role of the government in financial markets, right? And this is a decision that demands more political, arguably executive branch accountability, right? I mean, it's true.
Christina, I thought we already had that in the Dodd-Frank revisions to 13.3. It's a 2E thing. And Treasury does get to say, and did get to say in 2020, what the parameters of some of those programs were, particularly Main Street.
Yeah, no, I was just about to say that the Dodd-Frank Act did basically give, Treasury something of a veto in 13.3 facilities. But what I'm saying is that, it's not ideal to make those decisions in the moment of a crisis, right? Because it's going to be much more difficult for an executive, for a Treasury to put the brakes on when we're faced with a crisis. And I think real accountability would happen, right, if we sat down in non-crisis times and start to think about a more coherent coherent framework for the use, the deployment of 13.3 facilities that isn't just sort of ad hoc in the heat of the moment. It's the same sort of point that, you know, we've made, Andy and I made in connection with quantitative easing, right? When we're not faced with a crisis, come up with some sort of rules of the road, right? That we can at least sort of judge our actions by and not sort of just have to cobble things together in a crisis, because we're always going to be more permissive, more liberal when we're faced with a crisis. And that's just sort of gradually chipping away at market discipline.
Well, we have a fair number of questions here and we have only just a few minutes left. As with all anything dealing with the Fed, there's a range of questions, but actually the one that I'm going to just, I'm going to modify a couple of questions here, though, is to note that we have some commentators noting that, you know, President Trump has recently removed two of the directors on the FTC, actually mimicking what the Franklin Roosevelt did during the 1930s. And when Roosevelt removed a commissioner of the FTC, it resulted in the Humphreys Executor case, whereby the Supreme Court upheld removal restrictions on independent agencies. So this is a now kind of a direct challenge to a Humphreys Executor. So I think the question I want to, that we're getting through is, if Supreme Court, what impact would it have on Fed governance? Would it improve it, or would it undermine effective governance of the Fed? And maybe I'll start with you, Alex, and I'll work backwards this time.
I think that hypothesis is a good reason to emphasize the role of the Congress as the natural check and balance to the executive. I like to remind people that under the original Federal Reserve Act, the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board was the Secretary of the Treasury. Mm-hmm. And in a time of war or in a other crisis, there's a natural partnership between the Treasury that wants to finance things and the Fed, which can print the money to finance them with. And against, or on the other side, you might say, of that partnership, you need to have the Congress, in my view.
Okay. Don?
Yeah, so I, as I said, I'm not an attorney. My hope is that Humphrey's executor is not overturned. I think the country has been well served by independent agencies with turnover and with the possibility of the president to appoint a majority of most of these boards. I think if Humphrey's executor were overturned and included monetary policy, it would be very bad. I dare anyone to find a president who's advocated for tighter monetary policy. So I can go through Harry Truman, Lyndon Johnson, Ronald Reagan, who called Paul Volcker into his office in 1984 and ordered him not to raise interest rates. George H.W. Bush, Donald Trump. Tell me a president who's asked for a tighter policy to stop inflation. It's always the short term, easier policy. I'll get reelected, then I'll worry about what the next thing is. So I think an independent monetary policy, independent within, to Alex's point, Congress should be setting goals and the Fed should be held accountable for its interpretation of Congress's goal and then held accountable for meeting it. I would be very wary of reducing the independence of the Monetary Policy Authority. And I don't know that Humphrey's executor can be targeted at some functions and not other functions.
Christina, what's your view?
So in our 30 seconds remaining, you know, it's an interesting time. The Supreme Court is clearly poised to overturn Humphrey's executor, but at the same time, also clearly seems very reluctant to touch the monetary policy function of the Fed and has, you know, said various things along the lines of, you know, Humphrey's executor apply to a very specific kind of agency at a very specific point in time, which I read as potentially including, you know, monetary policy as something that is really close to that core, you know, quasi-legislative function, because Article 1 of the Constitution clearly gives you know, the monetary policy function to Congress, right? The responsibility to coin money and deal with the value of money. So if I were Congress and or the Fed, I would pay some attention to trying to separate monetary policy function from supervision and regulation, because blending the two makes life a whole lot more complicated for Fed governance if and when Humphrey's executor is overturned and we want to keep monetary policy as that quasi-legislative core of independence, you know, without necessarily complicating and muddying the waters with the other things that the Fed does now.
Well, I agree with you, Christina. I think the Supreme Court is hard to predict. And as we saw just recently in the case on the funding of the CFPB, where you had Clarence Thomas writing the majority opinion, the Supreme Court is certainly a body with independent thinkers, and they will come out sometimes in ways that is hard to predict. So we'll have to watch that case as it goes through. Well, listen, I want to thank our panel here for just a wonderful discussion of a complex but fascinating topic. And I want to turn it back over to Caroline.
Great. Thank you so much, Andrew. And I just want to echo you in thanking our speakers for the benefit of your time and expertise today. Thank you also to the audience members who joined us. We greatly appreciate your participation. Check out our website, fedsoc.org, or follow us on all major social media platforms at FedSoc to stay up to date with announcements and upcoming webinars. Thank you once more for tuning in. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.